Welcome to Season 3 of Sidebars, Kilpatrick Townsend's limited podcast series celebrating Women's History Month. I'm April Abley Isaacson, a patent litigator and office managing partner in San Francisco. The campaign theme for International Women's Day 2023 is #EmbraceEquity. Our guests this season provide important perspectives on embracing equity and empowering women.
I'm Kate Geyer, a patent litigation associate in Seattle. We're here to focus on equity for women in the legal profession and have candid conversations with leading professionals from diverse backgrounds.
And I'm Megan Bussey, a partner on our patent prosecution and patent litigation teams in New York. Our guests this season are authors, legal professionals, business development managers, legal coaches, and consultants for lawyers. Each of our guests provide us with a unique outlook on equity in the legal profession.
Hello, welcome back to Sidebars. In this episode, April and I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Aaron Reeves. Aaron is the founder and managing director of the research and advisory firm Nexions, which specializes in workplace culture change. Aaron began her career as an attorney and then went on to earn her PhD in sociology from Northwestern. Aaron has designed and led comprehensive research projects on topics including gender equity, generational diversity, LGBTQI diversity, racial and ethnic diversity, cultural integration, implicit bias, and transformational leadership. In addition to being a researcher and leading an advisor to many of America's top executives, Aaron is also a best-selling author. Her most recent book is entitled In Charge: The Energy Management Guide for Badass Women Who Are Tired of Being Tired. I personally had the pleasure of attending a CLE Aaron presented on implicit bias and have not stopped talking about it since, which April and Kate can attest to. And I've also really enjoyed your new book, which as a working mom of two with a spouse who also works full time, couldn't be more on point for my current season of life. So thank you so much for joining us, Aaron. And we really appreciate the chance to speak with you today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
I really loved your book. I felt like it was written for me, and I know we're going to talk about In Charge quite a bit later, but we're going to launch this episode on International Women's Day. And the International Women's Day 2023 campaign theme is #EmbraceEquity. Wanted to ask you, what does equity mean to you?
I think this is an interesting question because a lot of times people equate equity with equality. And the difference is that equity is a measure to correct inequity, right? I always tell people, like, we don't have an amendment in the U.S. Constitution that says men have the right to vote. We have an amendment that says women have the right to vote because that was an equitable measure to address the inequity that women did not have the right to vote. So when we talk about equity, it's rooted in some historical inequity. So we don't need to fight for equity in women, in women's representation in nursing, for example, because there has historically not been inequity there. But if you look at most positions of power in the world, women have not been represented, right? Not even close to parity of their representation in the population. So correcting that is what equity is. And it can mean different things, obviously, in different contexts.
I noticed that at the beginning of your book, it starts with, she is you, she is me, she is us. Can you talk to us about what you mean by that?
Yeah, when I started doing the interviews for the book, I was actually surprised at how similar women's stories were. Women in different industries, women who were white, women who were of color, women of different ages, and they were all exhausted from navigating and negotiating just the dynamics in their workplaces, right? So whether they were a secretary or a partner, it was just this constant awareness that, like, I have to enter the workplace as a woman, and then I have to navigate everything as a woman. And the exhaustion was so universal that it actually kind of took me by surprise that we talk so much about our differences, but why are women this universally exhausted and we're not talking about it, was what hit me. And I was like, then I saw myself too in what these women were saying. And I was like, so this is me. This is us. And we're all in our lives thinking it's just us. And there was a power to saying, it's not just you or me. It is us. And there's that we can do something about it, right? And that was where that first part, the page 3 to 6, was like a journal entry that just kind of like came out of me. It actually ended with, I shouldn't write this book because how can I write it when I'm going through the same thing? And my publisher came back and said, that's exactly why you should write it, because you are going through the same thing. And it ends with, you know, I'm a fellow traveler in this as much as I am a researcher, which I thought was important for me to disclose up front. Like, I don't have this figured out either, but let's learn it together.
Yeah, I think it was interesting because April and I were talking before we got on the podcast about how I was really connecting with your book from my perspective. And April and I have different challenges in home lives. And yet she was like, oh, I feel so connected to it as well. So it is really impressive how in reading that book, it really does seem to hit on the fact that this is a very universal feeling and that it's not just if you're a working mom or if you're married or if you're single or if you're really established in your career or if you're building your career, it's kind of an across the board experience.
And, you know, considering it's International Women's Day, like that is the one form of discrimination that is truly global and universal, right? Like race looks different country to country, religion looks different country to country, ethnicity, tribe. But it doesn't matter what culture you look at. There is this deep discrimination of women, and there's women's rights. There's a women's fight. So I think it's not just universal. You know, when we talk about the United States, it's universal globally. Of course, some women are fighting as what's going on in Iran right now, right? Like they're fighting for fundamental rights, but so are we. We're fighting for reproductive rights, right? And there are women fighting for the right to vote in some countries, and in other countries, they're fighting for the right to not get raped. So it varies in terms of extremes, but everywhere women are fighting to be equal. And I think that that universality just hits me sometimes too, in terms of how much more we need to be working together.
There was one interest. I mean, there's so many interesting quotes from your book that I feel like we could talk for 5 hours and we still wouldn't get through scratching the surface. But I'm just going to read one that I just really love and just kind of want to get your thoughts of what went into it, because it really resonated with me. But like you said, this is for every woman. She manages chaos she did not create and cleans up messes she did not make. She's not happy about it, but she knows complaining will only deplete energy. She does not have time to spare.
Yeah, it's women do a lot of the emotional work in workplaces, right? Women are asked to do more mentoring. They're asked to clean up messes. They're asked to be the people that create some kind of order out of chaos. And there's another part of the book where I talk about, I'm so sick of the articles that talk about how women learn, you know, need to learn how to say no. Women know how to say no. We say no all the time. Nobody respects it when we say no, right? So this idea of someone asks you to do something, to clean up a mess you didn't make, and of course your instinct is to say no, but you also know that if you say no, someone's going to say, oh, but can you please? And we don't know who else can do it. And you also know it's going to stay a mess if you don't clean it up. So no matter how much you want to say no, you end up doing it because you realize the amount of energy it's going to take to say no may in fact be more than the amount of energy it will take to just clean it up, even though it's going to exhaust you. And this idea that we are always called in to clean up messes we didn't make and create order out of chaos that we didn't create was something that I heard in so many women's lives, personal lives, professional lives, political lives, that it felt like it needed to be said out loud.
And I'm curious, before you started Nextions, you were a practicing attorney. Did you, yes, in that field experience this as I think many female attorneys did, but I'm curious what your personal experiences were like.
I loved law. I'm still a licensed attorney. I just don't practice professionally, but I still practice pro bono. I loved the law, but when I realized, you know, I was working up pro bono on a series of cases about domestic violence. And the case, it was all about, you know, these habeas corpus writs about around how self-defense didn't apply to women who were abused. Like the self-defense definition didn't apply because it doesn't, you don't win in that moment if you fight back in that moment. So you kind of wait for a second, right? And abuse operates on the mind very differently. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized like the legal system is a system of precedents. So we have no hope for change if we're looking to yesterday for how we rule. And the only thing that really seemed to change things is social science evidence, because it suggested the precedent was wrong. Not that the precedent wasn't the precedent, but that it was wrong. That was the case in Brown versus Board of Education with the psychology study. And this particular set of cases led to the battered women's defense, which was very different than the self-defense, right? And it allowed for what happened to your brain. So the more I thought about that, the more I was like, the way we're talking about gender in the law is all wrong. We need the social science perspective. That's what made me leave the law. But while I was a lawyer, I have to admit there was so much shit I put up with that I just thought was what you did, right? Like, I remember, this is way back, but I remember when, you know, my law school career person said, you have to wear a skirt to interviews. And I was like, I hate skirts. And she's like, you have to wear a skirt and you have to wear heels.
And pantyhose. Or, we were told you had to wear pantyhose.
Oh my God,
with your skirt.
Pantyhose. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that open-toed shoes were like not allowed, right? And it just seemed normal until I started working on these domestic violence cases. And I was like, how much of how we're treated do we just assume is normal because it's the way men normally like interact? And I remember when I was practicing law, I used to play basketball in high school, and I walked into the room and these three guys were talking about basketball. None of them played. I could have kicked each of their asses on the court. I know it. And they stopped talking when I walked in the room. And I was like, I know about basketball. They're like, oh, that's okay. We'll talk later. And I don't know why, but that sticks out in my mind. Like that just infuriated me because it was like, you all cannot even play. Like, are you serious? But it never, until I really went down the social science route, like I know it frustrated me and irritated me, but why was it so wrong? I didn't have the words to explain, right? And the social science, I think, gives us more words to explain that stuff. You are laughing, April. I want to know why you laughed.
No, I was laughing because, okay, it's like I had a few questions in mind before that, but I was laughing because I love basketball. I'm not a basketball player, but I love watching basketball. I love March Madness. And I remember being in a pool for the bracket with like out of the 25, most of them were hedge fund portfolio managers that were all dudes. And they thought they were so awesome. And it was this winner takes all. And I won the whole thing. So they were shit talking the whole time to me, thinking I was some idiot. And it was just, I loved that so much. So it kind of reminded me, it's like, no, we know about sports too. Like, yeah, you know, it's not just exclusively you. Yeah. So that's why I was laughing. But then, you know, your book that we've been talking about, In Charge, and then the subtitle is The Energy Management Guide for Badass Women Who Are Tired of Being Tired. And I saw in your book that you quote Mark Manson's book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And it reminded me of another badass woman lawyer, Katie Porter. I don't know if you saw that during the whole Kevin McCarthy, she's sitting there reading that book. And I could not stop laughing. Like all this chaos is going around her. And she's purposely reading that book. And then you had it, you quoted it in your book. So I'm kind of curious your thoughts about that book and, you know, just Katie Porter, because I think she's just such a subtle badass.
She is. And she's brilliant, right? Like the way that she explains things is like is just brilliant. But this idea of not giving a fuck is about, we care so much. I mean, like, you know, when someone says you curse too much, or when someone says, I'll never forget, it was like one of my first conference calls after the pandemic started. I was on Zoom, and it was a C-suite of a very large company. And there were three women in the C-suite, and they all looked so put together, right? Like their hair was done, their makeup was, everything was sharp. One of the C-suite dudes walks in. He's sweating. He has on like workout gear. And I was like, you sloppy shit. Like, why would you show up to an executive like leadership meeting? But he wasn't bothered by it. And the women were furiously chatting each other, right? Like, can you believe this? But the amount that we're taught to be terrified that we're going to be seen as not put together, like that it's going to impact the way that people see our professionality, whether they see our competency, that I started watching for that in the Zoom videos. And consistently what you saw is that women showed up uber professional every time, and the guys were just sloppy. And it was like, they don't give a fuck. Why do we get, and we spend so much time giving a fuck, right? The number of women who I coach who tell me how much time they waste in the mornings just trying to go, what do I wear? How do I wear my hair? Like, is this going to be okay? Who am I going to be in front of? What are they going to say? That this idea of not giving a fuck is just something that I just think that it is more natural for men who are overrepresented. And it actually is a real energy drainer for women. And somebody just opening that book and saying, I'm not going to disrespect you, but here's my message, is it's brilliant. She's just, yeah.
I was just thinking that I have a trip coming up for work. And I was like, yeah, I actually started a Rent the Runway subscription because I was like, oh, but I think everyone's seen all my work outfits. Like, these people have all seen my five outfits that I rotate through, and I can't appear that way. I need to have, you know, I need to be more put together. I need to ensure that, you know, I have an outfit for every occasion. And it really is. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of that mental energy that we talk a lot about, the constant thinking of to-do lists, managing, overseeing things, being the note taker, all that kind of energy that I really do think when I was reading your book struck me as that really is truly energy. And that we only have a certain amount. And you talked a lot about like the concept of entropy, but the fact is, you know, we don't have unlimited energy, and we need to find a way to, I can't find the quote exactly, but find what makes you happy and gives you energy and do more of that, and identify what makes you unhappy and takes your energy and try to cut out what you can there. And that really resonated with me. So I'm wondering what kind of led you to that solution in a way of trying to conserve?
I think what I found in myself, as well as a lot of the women that I talk to, is when women feel tired or they feel exhausted, they look for stuff to fix it, right? So we Google like self-care, and then we read these articles that tell us like, here's the 25 things that you have to do to take care of yourself. And you're like, shit, I barely had time to read that article. I don't have time to do these 25 things. And there is this notion that we can't not do the stuff that we're doing. There's like, we cannot stop doing certain things. So we keep looking to like manage our time better, or be more productive, or be more effective. And the truth is, we don't need to be doing a lot of the stuff that we're doing. And there's no amount of energy management that can help us if we are saddled with a bunch of stuff that we don't want to do. Like, that energy drain is greater than anything that will give you energy. But it seems like it doesn't always occur to us to stop doing things that make us unhappy, right? And I did this last year. I practiced saying, I don't want to, because I realized that when I say no, I say I can't because, and I like try to make it easy for the person to hear a no. And it was terrifying and awkward, and I stuttered, but I forced myself to say, I don't want to do that. Like, not that I can't.
That concept.
Oh my God, it was terrifying. And I started with family, and even there, like, one of my aunts asked me to do something, and I was like, I don't want to. And she was like, what? And I was like, I don't want to. There are other things I would prefer to do in that time, but I still love you, but I just don't want to do the thing you're asking me to do. And I remember, like, my hands were shaking as I said it. I was like, I'm never going to get away with this. Like, she's going to come over here and smack me. And then I started saying that at work. Like, if a client asked me to do something, I would say, I would prefer not to, as opposed to I can't, because I realized how disempowering it is when we say I can't do that. Because the truth is, I can, I could, I don't want to, right? And so I would say just once a week, try it to just remind yourself that there are things that are your energy, that are draining your energy, that you have a right to say you don't want in your life, and that you don't have to apologize for not wanting it. Right. And I was in a business situation the other day. I had finished drinks with someone, and they were like, oh, so let's just share an Uber, you know, back. And I was like, I don't want to. and he looked at me. He was like, what? I said, I'm drained. I really don't want to continue a conversation. I would really want to be by myself right now. I really just want to, I would like some solitude. I hope that's okay. And he was like, it's fine. And I was like, all right, well, I'll see you later.
I love it. Did you ever read the book? I read this short story when I think maybe in eighth or ninth grade, Bartleby the Scrivener, where he said, I would prefer not to. And as you remember, that was like so great. He just kept repeating it all the time. And I was looking up some other quotes. And this was, I think, a session you had with one of the women. And it was all caps, right? Because you said it was sort of like screaming. Yes. And it goes to your point. I can't do your shit anymore. Do your own shit. Please stop giving me your shit to do. Take your own notes. Why is it always me? And I was kind of like, wait, Aaron, you're one of us. Like, I know exactly what you're talking about. I could not stop laughing.
Oh, what was funny is I had a teammate who was an actress. And so this was a session of women on Zoom, and they were like putting this in all caps. And she was like doing a dramatic reading of each one. And at the end, I was like, you know, we were reading them out loud. Everybody was just in tears because it was like, make your own damn sandwich. I don't care. Like, it was just all this stuff. And at the end, this woman said, I can't tell if people are talking to their boss, their child, or their husband. And she's like, and that's what's really scary. Like, go make your own sandwich. I don't care what you need to do. It's not my problem. It's not my shit. And that kind of like led to the silence, because women realized how many different places in their lives they were swallowing those words. That was the exercise. Like, what do you really want to say that you're not saying? Because the truth is, it takes energy to not say it. Right? When you want to say to somebody, do your own shit, or it's not my problem, it takes a lot of energy to think it, prevent yourself from saying it, swallow it, and have to process it and absorb it, right? And that person is fine. Like, they've expended no energy impinging on your time and on your energy, but you've expended all this energy absorbing your most natural response to them. And it's just a perfect example of what exhausts women. Swallowing those words is an energy drain.
No, and it's totally true, because I was just thinking back. It was probably maybe 15, 16 years ago. I was in Boston, so it was a different law firm office, and I was defending a deposition. I was a partner at the time, so maybe it was after 2006. But in any event, this guy asked me, he's the opposing counsel, just, oh, can you just go make copies for me? And I was kind of like, no, I'm not making copies for you. And it was so outrageous, but it was stressful for me to have to do that. But there was no way I was going to make his copies. But I felt like having to say that was a stressful experience.
Yeah, because there was emotion involved, right? And then there's all the processing of, are you kidding me? Like, why would you ask me? Like, and there's processing. And then you say, no, but I don't even, you know, I don't know this story, but April, I guarantee you, like, every time you looked at him, like, that's what you saw the rest of the deposition, because you were like, are you freaking kidding me? Right. And so when you think about it, that same deposition at the end of it, you were more tired than him, because the amount of cognitive and emotional effort you had to put in to process what he put in front of you that wasn't yours to deal with and do your work is exactly this. Like, we process that. Or, you know, girls walking down the street who hear catcalls. Like, you process the tension, you process the, I can't say anything because it's dangerous for me to. You process the, why are you saying this? Why, like, I don't feel, you have to process all of that. And so a 2-block walk is exhausting, and you are close to tears and you are stressed out. The person who said that, they're fine. They said something and they moved on about their day. And you add up all of those things in your day on a daily basis, and it, we wonder why there isn't equity, right? Because women are exhausted. And a lot of women who leave law firms aren't leaving because some big bad thing happened. They usually are saying things like, I just can't do it anymore. I'm too tired. There's got to be something better. And it's this eroding of our energy level until we just say no more. And so if we're looking for, like, equity in leadership, we're looking for equity in representation, how can we possibly aspire to that when women are exhausted, right? Like, we don't have the energy to do that every day. And that, I think, is, I tried to make the book, like, funny and interesting to read, but there's an underlying tragedy there of how exhausted women are and how much it's affecting our health that I don't think we should forget.
It's part of the equity tax, basically, for being a woman in the workplace.
It is. If you are embracing equity, embrace not exhausting women, right? Like, just stop doing stuff that is exhausting to women. And if you don't know what that is, ask, because every woman in your life will tell you all the stuff that is exhausting her. But it's a big, it's not just about, like, promotions and compensation and equity and those things. It's equity in our ability to have our energy to ourselves and use it the way we want, and not to always be using up all this energy reacting to stuff that's not our shit, not our problem.
I know you do advise executives and people in positions of leadership. So what would you advise someone in a position of leadership in a law firm, say, about what they can do to help women retain their energy, to not deplete the women in their workforce like this?
I mean, I think first, I say this to a lot of, like, partners and leaders in law firms, but stop calling it a woman's problem. It's not a woman's problem. The woman is experiencing the problem, right? But it's not a woman's problem. It's a firm problem. If you are not retaining women, if women are leaving at a faster rate than men, that means, I remember I was talking to a group of CEOs one time, this was many years ago, and the CEO stood up and said, Erin, I need you to help me with the woman problem. And I said, okay, let's start with how, what you're calling it. And I was like, so you're hiring 50% men and women. And he said, yeah. And I said, and the women are leaving and the men are not. He said, yeah. I was like, so 50% of the women you hire are rejecting you. That sounds like a you problem, not a woman problem, right? It sounds like the same thing that women are doing is saying, you are not good for me. This workplace isn't good for me. I'm leaving. So stop trying to say, like, what do women need to fix, or what do women need? It's what does the workplace need to do differently to cause women to stop rejecting it? So if I think when law firm leaders are thinking about retaining and advancing more women, if you think about it as a rejection of the firm, you think about it as a different problem than why are women leaving? They're not leaving, they're rejecting you, right? And so what is it about you that they're rejecting? Now, that's a good question to ask women, and women will be more than happy to tell you. But that's a different problem than why are women leaving? So I think it's about understanding that there are structural issues, implicit bias for sure, but just that kind of stuff. Can you make copies for me? Can you please organize the call? Can you do the organizing? You know, can you do the case management piece because you're so good at organizing while your male colleague does the deposition or does the, you know, expert witness prep? Really think about what are the things that women are being asked to absorb and confront that stuff so that you can reduce the energy drain. And then I think the rejection rate will decrease.
I know when I was looking at your website, it said, you know, you do cutting edge research and consulting, focusing on leadership and inclusion. To that point, if you do see that there's kind of that sort of an issue that you described, and obviously do, you know, that would be the firm doing some sort of investigation, speaking to some of the people that don't feel included, including women, obviously, what would be your advice to them of what they need to do institutionally to change things?
A big thing is like focus on the outcome. Like I think in law firms, for example, really understanding what is the output that you want to measure people on as opposed to how and when they work, right? And I think that's a big thing with flexibility and with women. It's what do you want done at the end of the day? If it's getting done, leave her alone as to like where she's doing it, when she's doing it, how she's doing it. And then also just, you know, I mean, you can do an implicit bias training specifically on gender. For example, we know through research that when a woman has a child, people assume she's less committed to work. But when a man has a child, they assume he's more committed to work, right? So people tend to invest in men more and they start divesting in women when they have children. Or if, you know, a woman says that she has something related to family, that people immediately get on alert that it's a conflict of some sort. But if a man says that, it's like, oh, he's such a great dad, right? So pay attention to those like subtle things that go through your mind and say, if this was a man, would I say the same thing? Or if this was a woman, would I say the same thing? As leaders, if leaders can really start some critical self-dialogue with themselves about why do I think this? If I swapped out a man for a woman, would I say the same thing? Those kinds of things really help leaders understand their own vocabulary and sometimes understand their own biases.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all that. And I also think there's just a certain level of acceptance that the fact is, you know, women biologically, we have children. Yes, a lot of places do have leave, but I think people still fail to just really embrace that this is something we need to, you know, have a way of maintaining the women in the workplace, even if they do choose to have children or, you know, become a parent. And yes, you have a leave policy, but maternity and paternity are not the same thing. I've heard them compared by people, and it's like, well, generally speaking, especially if you have a maternity leave based on a delivery, you know, there's a physical rehabilitation there. This was an actual physical change to your body. It was very difficult. And, you know, that's not the same experience of somebody on a paternity leave who also has flexibility, where I've seen people take, well, I'm going to take a week of paternity now, and then I'm going to go back to work for a week so I can stay, you know, connected to my clients and my partners. And I'm going to come back and do another week of paternity, and then I'm going to go back to work. And so I think, you know, even if you are connected to your job, and I've had two children, I've been through two maternities at this firm. I've been with this firm since I was a summer associate, and I'm still here because of the opportunities that were afforded to me to create this flexible lifestyle that you talked about. But it takes a lot of work, both on my end and on the end of the people I work with. And I think continuing to have firms and people in leadership really as you said, not immediately dismiss somebody who wants to start a family, but also embrace flexibility. I think flexibility to me is like the most important thing potentially, because the fact is there's only so much time in the day. You only have so much energy and you need flexibility to make it all work.
Yeah, I think the stories that I think get me the most are how much planning it takes for a woman to tell people that she's pregnant, right? It is like a miraculous.
So it's the scariest thing.
Yes.
It is the scariest thing I probably had to do in my career was go into someone's office and say, it always comes out in a way you don't even plan.
Yes.
I got pulled in and I got, someone said, you know, I've noticed you're not coming into the office anymore. And, you know, you really need to be here. And I honestly teared up and was like, I am so sick. And I wasn't going to say anything because I'm not 12 weeks yet, but like, I just can't. Like, I've slept on the floor of my office because I feel so terrible. And it's a really scary thing to say to a position, someone who has your career in their hands.
And just think about that for a second, right? Think about how freaking inhumane that is, that exactly at the time in a woman's life when she cannot be stressed out, right? The time in her life when she needs to be like as peaceful as possible because her whole body is changing and she's puking and sleeping at, you know, sometimes both at the same time. It's the culture of law firms is creating fear in being able to say it. And that fear is not irrational because women know, it's not like women made this up in their heads. Women know that the minute you say it, the minute you say, I am pregnant, people are forecasting 8 months ahead, 9 months ahead, a year ahead and saying, I'm not going to put her on that. I'm going to start taking her off now. And so just that, I think if male leaders can just grapple with that fact alone, what are you doing culturally that is causing insane fear in a woman? Right when it's literally the time in her life when fear is poisonous to her body. Start there and see if that works for you. Is that okay? Like, this is the whole, like, stop giving a fuck. Like, I don't know how else to say it sometimes, but maybe I've been doing this too long. But like, I've stopped talking about like leave. This is what I talk about with leaders sometimes. And I'm like, have you ever just asked a woman how terrified she is of saying I'm pregnant, or how she buys bigger clothes to try to hide it for weeks and weeks until she has to say it? Like, that is so inhumane to me. It is the opposite of caring of any kind, that I think if leaders just sat with that, like, if a woman in your firm gets pregnant, her first thought is shit. How am I going to tell people at work you're doing something wrong? Right? And how will you know you're doing it right when a woman doesn't say shit as the first reaction to being pregnant? So I think that's, and I know that that doesn't help like on an organizational level, but on a human level, it just feels so important that, I don't know, that men and male leaders here, the emotional impact of the culture of not taking women seriously when they're moms or having a baby. I know that's not exactly what you asked. It's just something I feel very strongly about because I did it too. I hid both my pregnancies as long as I could.
Well, and I just want to say from my personal perspective, Megan, you really are someone who is very inspirational, because I know you were a younger mom, had the two kids and made partner at the firm. You didn't necessarily get to have the career that you envisioned. I think you told me you felt like, you know, a little piece of your soul gets crushed or something along those lines. But you really are, people like you are inspirational to have figured out a way to be flexible and make it work on your own terms.
Yeah. And I think another thing was in your book, Erin, that actually really resonated with me was this section where you said, we just need to take a good hard look at what our goals are. and be unflinchingly honest with ourselves if the ex we are chasing is the ex we really want. And I feel like that has probably been my like North Star in at least my life, is this constant reevaluation of like, what do I really want? What is my real priority? Because the fact is, you cannot have it all. I'm sorry. It doesn't exist.
You can have it all over the course of your lifetime.
Over the course of your lifetime. I love that. And it's this constant reevaluation. And there was a time when, you know, I was had very young children and I worked less and I took pay cuts and I did all that. And there was a time when my kids got older and my husband was more secure in his job. And I said, it's me time. And I'm going to, you know, now I'm going to ramp up on work. And it's this constant evaluation of, where do I want to be putting my energy? Where do I want to be putting my focus? What's really important to me right now? But I feel like you have to have that what you put in here really struck me, because you really do need to be honest with yourself. And you also need to be willing to realize that that's going to change. And it's not always going to be the same. And you need to be able to pivot.
And you don't have to be honest with everyone else. But you can lie to people all you want about your goals, right? You just cannot lie to yourself. Because the decisions you're making about where you put your energy has to be authentic to you. But strategically, you don't have to tell everybody about it, right? And that's okay. But I find that so many women aren't honest with themselves, that they don't really want this, or they want something different than what they're chasing.
Mm-hmm. Or it changes over time. What you thought you wanted and then what you end up wanting is different. I know that you also do research on generational differences, and Megan and I had talked, I think, last week, and we were very, very interested in that. So I'm a Gen Xer, kind of on the older end of Gen X, and she's a millennial. And, you know, I remember noticing, I think, around 2011-ish, that things were a little bit different with some of the summer associates and kind of how they communicated as millennials were coming in the workforce. You know, we need to be thoughtful about generational differences. And one of the quotes I liked that you have in your book from Madeleine Albright is, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. And I will tell you that from my perspective, for the most part, the baby boomer women were those women that did not help, because they were just figuring out a way to scrape by themselves. And they sort of thought, well, good luck, you know, to you Gen Xers, figure it out.
I mean, I think baby boomer women were the first generation of women to come into the workplace. And they, you talked about selling a piece of your soul, right? Or losing a piece of your soul. They really did have to put a lot of their soul on hold or leave it at the door in order to survive. And I think it's not that they don't have other women's backs. It's that they genuinely never thought that women could do it differently than how they did it, right? Like, they genuinely never thought that, like, you could just ask for it. And I'm a Gen Xer too. And I have the same thought sometimes when I see, they're not always, you know, the nicest thoughts. But sometimes when I hear younger women, like the Gen Z women, come in and say, you know, that for my mental health, I don't want to do that. And I was like, at the cost of my mental health, right? Like, I'm doing it instead. But I do. But at the same time, I'm proud of them that they are saying, I need something different. And I didn't think that I could, right? When I was working. So I think the generational differences for women specifically come from the fact that each generation starts from where the previous generation left off. And so we don't oftentimes have the imagination because of our own experiences for what it's like to grow up, you know, there. At the same time, you look at the reproductive rights issue. And if we take our eyes off the ball, those gains that we make generation to generation are not a given, right? They're not a given. And so I think women have to do a better job of communicating, look, this is what I believe because of my experiences. I can't see what you're saying. Like, I literally don't understand what you're saying, but how can I help you? Right? I don't understand you. I don't understand the goals that you're saying, but how can I help? And that's where I think we don't have to understand each other to have each other's back. And I think that crosses racial lines. It crosses like sexual orientation lines. And I've gotten much better now at when a woman, when I feel like a woman is so different from me and I don't understand her experiences at all, that I can still say at the end of not understanding and maybe even like not liking, I can still say, how can I help you? Right. And how can I help? And I think we need to do more of that with each other. We're not going to agree. We're not going to see eye to eye. And generational differences are real. But at the end of the day, I think Gen Z women need to say to Gen X women, like, how can I help? And Gen X women need to say, how can I help? And be, I mean, we all need to be saying, oh my God, I have no idea what you just said, but how can I help you is what I'm hoping that community concept comes back to. And I think that's maybe where Madeleine Albright, you know, with her generation was getting to, that like, we do owe each other this. Or I think more importantly, we cannot get to equity without it. We cannot get to equity without doing it together.
What I really like about what you just said is it makes me realize that I think naturally we as humans tend to think, well, I can help you if you want to do it the way I did it, because that's what I know. But whoever's in that position, their personal goals or personal struggles, they're probably going to know best what they need to succeed. And so going to them and saying, you tell me, I want to help you. You're on a different path than me. How can I help you along that path? Just makes so much sense, but also wasn't something I had thought about. I always think about telling people, well, here's how I did it. I don't know how you're going to do it. This is how I did it, but that might not work for you. But turning to the person and saying, what do you need? How can I help? Can be powerful.
It is powerful. And to be honest, I haven't heard it that much in my life, right? Like I haven't. And so, but I imagine that if I had, there would be so many places where my journey would have been a little easier, even if it was very different than the journey of the women who would have helped. And I figure if I know that my journey would have been easier if people had said that, like, how can I help, Erin? Even though I have no idea what you're talking about, like, how can I help you? I've made it a point to, one, say yes to things that women ask. And to say, like, how can I help? Which is, I think, a powerful way of supporting each other. Like I said, you don't have to understand each other to have each other's back.
Well, we are starting to get some of the Gen Zs in the workforce, because I know there's some second year associates that were born in 96. So they're the Gen Z. But it's really interesting, because what I found is that I try to ask some of the associates how they like to be managed, or, you know, how do they like to communicate, things like that. And I find that that's been really helpful. And also making, you know, if let's say it's an email to a client, I have enough trust in them to know they know how to send a professional email by some point. And then I ask them, well, do you want me to look at it? I can, you know, to try to give them some of that agency. And I feel like that's worked, just to kind of get where they are. And it was a male associate. He said, oh, I actually like to send the emails to the client because I think it makes them feel good, you know, and special. So then it was kind of good to know, right, that that's where he was coming from. I thought it was really cute.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of biases about generations. Some of them are well earned. And at the same time, I don't know, it's the more I look around the world and see how the gender issue just keeps sliding back, it's become a big source of, we are the majority of the population, like literally in the world, like we're 51% of the population. How is it possible that we're, and one of the things is because we're not working together as much. And if we really start working together, I cannot imagine that progress will continue to be slow, but I'm an eternal optimist. What do I know?
I mean, I think that's certainly the hope in all the way down the line. I mean, I look at the numbers of women graduating law school, the number of women graduating at the top of their law school. And then you compare that to the number of women, you know, in positions of leadership in law firms, in partnership, number of women, you know, we've had guests talk about arguing, you know, in the courts. and kind of those first chair roles. And my hope really is, like you said, that if we all say, what can I do to help? Then hopefully we'll see some improvement in those numbers carrying through, because the skill and the desire is there.
Absolutely. And more than there, right? Like, one of the dirty secrets in the United States is that almost every college in the United States applies affirmative action to even out the gender ratio in their classes, because women are 60% of college graduating classes, right? And so they, and women are a much higher percentage of the top grade getters in high school. So the talent is there. It is shining. So we have to mess with it at some point in order to make the numbers look the way they are. The talent is there. The ambition is there. The energy is there. But I think we drain it out.
I saw something the other day that was saying, oh, wow, now there's 10% of CEOs of big companies are female. Like, that was some wonderful achievement. And I was thinking, wow, we're 50% plus of the population, and we're excited about 10% women representation as CEOs. Curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I'll see how long it's 10%, because we've hit 10% before. And we have these spikes sometimes when we go from like 4% to 5%, and then we hit 10%. And within 3 years, it's back to like 5%. And this has happened multiple times since 2000. You can all think about those years where suddenly you hear about like three or four, female CEOs. And I think that when we see consistent and not this ups and downs, like 10%, 9%, like when we see some consistent increase, I think I'll get my hopes up. But sometimes, I don't know, it seems, I'm a little cynical about this, but it seems that women are sometimes hired to make a point, and you see these like splashy hires that companies will make. And there's some research that sometimes companies hire women when they know it's a really tough job. That it's not a job someone could be successful at, given what the company's going through. And then before you know it, 3-4 years later, the woman is gone. So I'm hopeful, but just need to see some steady numbers. But 10 is not something we should celebrate.
Well, and based on what you just said, it's kind of sometimes it's set up for failure, really.
Yeah. It's something, one researcher actually calls it the glass cliff. That women are hired literally into a position where the entire board knows that it's going off a cliff. That is when women are hired, because it's easier to make it about a woman not making it as opposed to the job or the board or whatever it was impossible to deal with.
Do you think there are any changes on a higher level of leadership positions, CEO roles, you know, the people who have these very difficult jobs that have always, for the last however many years, have had certain expectations? This is what the job looks like. This is what the hours look like. This is what your home life as an effect must look like. Do you think there needs to be any changes to those expectations and how we view those roles to help women long-term succeed and maintain those positions?
The research that I've seen is that it's not the job, it's the social stuff around the job that actually adds a lot of hours to CEO positions. So the job itself is actually very doable, but it is the amount of social stuff that you're supposed to do, the whining and the dining of the board and all of that, that it isn't so much that women don't have time to do it, but the research is pretty clear that it actually isn't necessary. Right? So people, I think, sometimes get really sensitive saying, well, should we mess with these jobs or not? Well, let's not mess with the job itself. But let's mess with all the stuff that CEOs are expected to do, or like managing partners. That's not the actual job, but that we say is the whining, the dining kind of stuff. And that's actually where, I mean, it's the same thing with business development in law firms. The actual business development women are amazing at, but it's the networking events and the client events that women say they don't have time for, right? But if you take like origination out, if you look at client retention dollars, women actually have higher percentages of retaining clients. That's client development. That's client work, right? But I think there is these remnants of like Mad Men 1950s, like we sit around and we drink. Were you thinking about that, April?
That's exactly, I'm laughing because this is exactly what I was going to say. Are these vestiges, this unnecessary whining and dining, vestiges of the past? And I was thinking exactly Don Draper, where, you know, one of them would have a wife that is going into labor and they're all going out to drink because God forbid you go to the hospital to see your wife and, you know, just go drink, which I thought was hilarious.
And the jokes were also that we're working late so we don't have to go home, right? They're all vestiges of that. That's the golf games, right? And it's, you're seeing, I think, a newer generation of men saying, I don't want to do that because I actually want to be at home and I want to be, you know, part of my family. But yes, the workplace of the 50s determined this idea that like you, I mean, that's where the drinking culture comes from. That is where the boondoggle culture comes from. It's this culture of we want to be with each other. We don't want to be at home. And you've got an entire population of people who are like, I don't want to be with you. I want to be at home. So it's not the job. It's all the stuff surrounding jobs that we've said are the job that actually are causing, you know, a bigger issue. Think about it. Like, just like in the 50s, it's exactly where sexual harassment takes place. It's where women have to negotiate all kinds of impropriety, right? It's also the 50s. The men in the 50s determined the average temperature of offices. That is why women are always cold. Like, we haven't changed the average temperature of office buildings since the 50s. That's when it was set, because it was women. I mean, it was men in suits who were drinking, who were like, it's really hot. Keep the office temperature cold. So much of our workplace culture is derived from the 50s. It's ridiculous. It's, which is why I think women are pushing back against coming back into the workplace. Like, yes, I want to come back to a certain extent, but I also don't need to be in the office to do good work, is the sharpest kind of shift from that 50s culture. But yes, Don Draper, the train leaving like downtown Manhattan with all the guys in their hats. There's a lot more remnants from that than we fully understand.
So for anyone listening in New York who is familiar with the Metro North, there was a very big outcry when they got the new train cars and the bar cars got dismantled and there were no more bar cars on the train. And that was like a big thing. I know someone, a friend of a friend, who bought one of the bar cars and it is in the backyard of their house because it was such a memorable, special part of his day, that every day you get on that bar car with your friends, they all meet on the train, and it's a social thing. And it's very much a part of the culture still.
And they were not responsible for childcare, right? So,
well, I thought it was interesting. One thing you said that, April, you and I have discussed is that you made a comment, Aaron, about, yes, there's some aspects, you know, business development or some, not necessarily whining and dining of the board, but relationships in these roles, CEO, managing partner, that women do, they just do it differently.
Exactly.
And a lot of times they do it more successfully, you might say. And April and I have talked about that experience, where I think that's a really great point, that a lot of times women do something different. And the initial response from, you know, the person who maybe is their superior or the person they're working with, who's maybe even a colleague who's from a different generation, is like, well, that's not how I did it. So I don't think that's the right way of doing it. And there's not a lot of open-mindedness to, well, just because I'm doing it differently and women do think differently, we might have different styles, doesn't mean it's wrong and doesn't mean it's going to be less successful.
Which is why, like the previous point that I made, is what leaders can do is focus on the outcomes that you want, not the process, right? A lot of studies have been done on negotiation styles, for example. If you look at actual negotiation results as determined by, you know, what people went into negotiation wanting, women get better results than men. But when men and women watch men and women negotiate, they consistently say the man is the better negotiator because the man negotiates with, like, you know, the fist pounding, like the no, et cetera. Women negotiate very differently. So if you didn't look at the style, if you didn't pay attention to how the negotiation happened, you just look at the outcome, you get a very different result. And I think it's the same thing with clients. Like if you take a look at who the clients call when they have work, when they have new matters, and every client that I've, every, you know, large company that I work with that does internal in-house satisfaction surveys of their law firms, women get much higher ratings, right? Of who do you trust? Who do you want to work with? Who do you feel is responsive? But they don't have the commensurate credit inside firms. So if you look at the, if you just look at the output of, if you ask the clients, who do you want to work with? You would get a very, very different result than like origination or who goes out with clients, et cetera. So I think all of these things are fine. It's fine for everybody to do it differently. The reality is if you look at results, you cannot argue with women's styles. But women's styles don't look like how it's always been done, which is where a lot of the bias comes from.
So that we can wrap up, because it's just been absolutely fabulous. And like I said, we could do this for 5 hours if we could and we had that time with you. But what advice would you give to someone who finds themselves as the first or the only in the room?
Just remember, you deserve to be there. You're the only one in the room, not because, you know, you're not isolated being in there. You're exceptional being in there. And I think sometimes when you are the only person in the room, you start worrying if people are looking at you. And the answer is, yes, they're looking at you. Yes, you're exceptional. No, you don't have to be anybody other than yourself. And I think that we have been socialized to believe that if we're the only in the room, we have to work to fit in and not stand out. And I've seen the opposite be successful. When you are the only person in the room, everybody notices it. So go ahead and stand out, right? Be yourself. Understand how exceptional you are. That's why you're there. And act accordingly. Everybody else is average in the room, right? Like if there's 9 men and you, the 9 could be easily replaced with each other, but you can't. And so step into that a little bit more. And I think that it's, I know it's easier said than done, but a lot of the people, really successful people I've talked to, have said that they get to a point in their life where they just say, oh my God, I'm the only one that looks like me here. So I will step into how unique and amazing and exceptional it is, as opposed to trying to blend it.
I love that. Well, thanks again for your time.
Of course.
This has been such a wonderful experience. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today. Subscribe to Sidebars on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or your preferred platform. And don't forget to rate or leave a review.
If you have any questions or feedback on this or any other episode of Sidebars, or if there's a topic for a future episode that you'd be interested in having us explore, please reach out to us at socialmedia@kilpatricktownsend.com.
If you enjoyed Sidebars, we invite you to check out Kilpatrick Townsend's Medicine and Molecules blog at kilpatricktownsend.com to read, watch, and listen to other related insight. You can also follow us on social media and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We'll put that information in the show notes. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and are not those of Kilpatrick Townsend.